The sixth lecture deals with decision support systems architectures. That's the arrangement of the physical and software components that enable us to have a decision support system in an organization, and the information technology infrastructure. Also, the networks that we use for remote access to our servers, especially web servers, and then security issues. Now you might ask, why does Chapter 6 look at all three of these issues? Well, there was clearly a space issue. I didn't want to have three chapters that dealt with each issue. But it seemed that these are closely linked in that the architecture is heavily dependent on the network for its effectiveness. And we need to think about the existing architecture when we increase or expand our network. And both the network and the architecture influence the security of the system. And security policies, what we do to maintain and manage security in the network, influences how secure our network is and how secure the architecture is in terms of intrusion. So all three of them need to be looked at in a holistic fashion, and Chapter 6 tries to do that. Well, we design architectures, we design networks, and we usually implement our security systems and we implement our security protocols, but sometimes we also implement some software to support security in the organization, like firewalls, and that may also be part of a hardware solution to provide security to our network. When we design architecture, networks, and securities, we want to try to minimize our support costs. So if we have a firewall that protects our network from intrusion from outside the organization, we want it to operate pretty much without a lot of either user activity or IT intervention to keep that firewall operating. We don't want it to be a major burden for internal users to get out, but we want to keep unwanted traffic from getting into our network. And as we minimize the support and costs, we want to maximize user productivity. So we want to always think about how the architecture and the networks and the security that we have in place influence the productivity of our users, both of IT systems and of decision support systems. We want to try to avoid system crashes and other performance problems. So if we're in a small firm with 40 people and we run with a local area network and a server, we want to make sure that server has 95 to 98% uptime and that we take it down on weekends when nobody uses it. We don't want it to crash at 3 p.m. every day. And I heard a horror story about a firm here in the local area that just a few years ago, every day at about 2:30 in the afternoon, their server would crash. Now, it wasn't clear to the IT people why it crashed. It could have been too many concurrent users. It could have been installation problems with the software. But it crashed. And that meant that they had to send employees home early every day until they finally decided to invest in more hardware. They threw capability at the problem rather than trying to figure out if they could do a better installation of the software or manage the load on the server. More than likely, the next time they get more traffic, either video from YouTube or more traffic from something like Second Life in a virtual world, that server is going to crash again because they have some serious management issues with the software and with the load in terms of the architecture design. So we want to minimize crashes and other performance problems. You don't want to have to wait a long time for a web page to load. You don't want to wait to get a database query completed. The third thing we want to think about when we design the architecture and the networks we have in the organization and our security infrastructure and policies is how the current infrastructure may delay development of new applications, especially decision support applications. So we want to look at capacity, slack, how much additional traffic we can put on the network, how much additional storage we have on our network for more data, and what happens if we bring in a lot of external users to our internal network in terms of our firewalls and our security. So we want to think about expansion possibilities with the current capabilities we have with the infrastructure. In the first chapter, we talked about major components, and the framework that we're using in class looks at these components. We know the user interface is the most important component, and the user interface is what people think the decision support system is. It helps us access capabilities that are part of our architecture. Oftentimes, our user interface is a thin client that works on our computer, and we use a network to access models or data or documents. We know that the database and documents and any rules engines that we have run on servers. We house them on servers, and the servers have to process requests. So that's an important part of the architecture. The same thing with models and analytical tools. Those models have to be processed. They have to be accessed from the user interface. And then that component that we call communications and network infrastructure, that's the network and more. It's also how we allow people to access the network and what we do for network management and network access. Slide number 4 is a summary of some of the network needs that we have for different kinds of decision support systems. Today, data-driven DSS that use large data stores are almost always network-enabled. So on the chart it says usually. There might be an exception when you want that large storage capacity to be basically inaccessible except for a very limited number of users who have direct access to the data storage. But it would be a very sensitive kind of database, perhaps a National Security Administration database or something like that. The thin client that we would tend to use for access would be web pages or a Java applet that makes it accessible to us. Document-driven DSS are also usually network accessible, although we still have standalone document systems where you have to go to the physical device to look at documents that are stored on some optical character recognition system. When it's networked, the documents might be in HTML or PDF documents or some other document storage format, like a Word document. Model-driven DSS, sometimes, and it's becoming more common, but lots of model-driven DSS are only used by a few people in the organization, so it's easier to distribute it to the individual's machine and then perhaps provide data. So if we do a model-driven DSS in Excel, we distribute the Excel application, it runs on the client, and perhaps somebody downloads some data from a SQL Server database. If a model-driven DSS is network-enabled, we may actually develop the model in Java or JavaScript, which is part of the Web 2.0 interface. JavaScript is part of what we talk about when we look at the more modern interactive data-driven applications. And JavaScript has some programming capabilities we can put into a web page. Knowledge-driven DSS, more common now. You're going to read a case study from a company called Exsys. It's a case study at the Pennsylvania Department of Labor where they distributed a knowledge-driven DSS to over 600 people statewide using a web server and thin client. It wasn't too many years ago there was no way we could distribute knowledge-driven DSS, but now we can with web pages. Sometimes we can use a distributed application built in Java, but web pages are most common. Communications-driven DSS are always going to be based on a network because we have multiple participants. We need to involve more than one person. Now, it could still be a local area network, but it's most likely today to be a web-based application. It could be web pages, it could be Java, it could be JavaScript, it all depends. It could even be written in C or some other kind of language if it's client-server. Now, I put up inter-organizational there. Now, that's a purpose. With inter-organizational, we're talking about the target users. We're talking about people outside the organization who want to use our decision support capability of whatever type. If we want to make it available to external users, we have to use some kind of a network capability, and today that means the internet. It could be coming through a private network over the internet where we basically restrict access to people who have some kind of a secure client, or they come through our firewall. But if we want external users to use our system on our architecture, on our hardware, we have to use a network to enable them to get into our system. So there's a lot of information on that slide. The next slide, how we distribute data, has much less. But if you read the chapter, you'll see that basically we can have the user interface on the client. And if we do that, it could be a thick client or a thin client. If it's thin client, the user interface is out on the server and we download it to the browser. But we could also bring the database onto the client, either download it or have it there. So thick client can have lots of the architecture of the decision support system on the client machine. Thin client means we have very little of the architecture on the machine. Most of the architecture of the decision support system is out on our IT infrastructure. The database is on a database server. The models are on a model server. We have a web server that's operating that allows us to distribute that. And somewhere in between is when we take a program called a Java applet, some code that may be very rich in the interface, and we send it over the internet and we use the browser with Java enabled to show us a richer client. The main problem with Java applets is it can take a long time to send that code over the internet, even with a high-speed connection, and lots of companies disable Java in the browser because they're concerned about security threats. So the most common way we distribute decision support is with thin client. If we have a model-driven DSS, we may use thick client, where we basically put everything onto the client machine. If we use Excel and we mail out the Excel application, that's thick client architecture. Okay, we've pretty much talked about how we manage the models. Again, the model could be distributed to the client server in a tool like Excel, or we could have it on a server that's dedicated to doing, say, mathematical optimization with linear programming. Have a specialized server that just processes models. Just like we have database servers, we can have model servers. Now, this word architecture comes from building things. We had architectures long before we had computer systems. And we've had architects as a profession for a long time. So if you think about your construction cost estimating DSS, there you have an architect who designs the house and they give you some plans. And then you have a builder who translates those plans into a house. And that builder is going to take the plans and they're going to estimate the cost for the foundation, for the framing, and then all the other things that go into the house. The roof, the windows, all the components that are specified by the architect who does the conceptual design for that house. Now, the architect is responsible for making sure that that house conforms to building codes and that it doesn't fall down when it's built. With IT architectures, we also have people who make sure that the architecture that we create for our information system and our information technology conforms with standards and that it doesn't fall apart when we put load or traffic either hitting a database server or going over the network. And then we still have to have people who build it. They install the servers, they run the wires. There are lots of building things that happen with information technology. Some of the questions we answer in terms of the architecture and networking is how the hardware is going to be organized. So the hardware may be a firewall server. It may be a domain name server. It may be a password and authentication server for the network, where all of the usernames and passwords are stored so that we only have you only have to have one password and you can sign on to a lot of different systems. We're trying to do that today. We're also concerned about how software is distributed. What machines have what software on them and why we have it on those machines. We want to reduce the cost of upgrading our software. So oftentimes we'll distribute software from a central server to individual clients so we can do updates. So when you sign on, you may have access to the software. And then how data is distributed. I've started using Google Apps. I know some of you have used that for your projects. How many of you have used Google Apps? So I've been using the document program where you can go in and collaboratively edit documents with another person in Google Docs. And the nice thing is it backs up automatically your documents, but it's shared automatically with the people I want to share it with. So everybody that is working collaboratively with me on this paper can see the latest version of it. And I can roll it back to an earlier version if I don't like the changes they've made. And it works a lot like Microsoft Word, but it's a collaborative word processing tool. Now there's also a collaborative spreadsheet at Google Apps. The bad thing is that it doesn't have any development capabilities. But I think I mentioned this in class. You can actually set up a spreadsheet and then you can send out to people to collect data and it goes into the spreadsheet in Google Apps. So you can use that as a data collection tool too. Is basically you set up a data form that would be sent out by email to people. They'd fill out that form and it would automatically go into your Google application. The spreadsheet that you had in Google Apps, which is kind of neat for decision support too. Because once you get your data, then you can analyze it. And a big part of architecture and networking is integration. One of the best paying jobs in IT and information systems is system integrator. Those are the people who are smart enough to take an existing system and figure out how to go from what you have to what you want. So they know what pieces to keep, what to buy, how things can interface, what protocols you have to use, what software you need to buy to bridge from where you are to where you want to go. They pull it all together and they make sure it works. So it requires that you have a great understanding of both information technology and also software and how the hardware fits together. But system integration is an important job, and it pays pretty well. Slide number 8 is a picture of a physical architecture, and it shows how the information technology may also include things like your phone, because a lot of that is digital now. So in addition to database servers, we may also have and file servers, we may also have places where you can get your messages. And architectures are becoming more complex, but they're also becoming more distributed. So there's a lot more to think about when we put together IT in an organization. And the bigger and more distributed the organization, the more complex it is. Here we've got basically 4 buildings that we want to network together, and we're not using the internet. We want this to be a wide area network, that connects these different buildings. All right, well, we build our decision support systems on the existing infrastructure and the existing IT architecture. We oftentimes can't afford to make major changes in the architecture to build our decision support system because it raises our costs. So we have to look and see if we have the capabilities in the architecture and the infrastructure to create our decision support system. Now, if it's a big enterprise-wide project, we may also have to spend money to enhance our architecture. The most common thing today is to make our decision support systems accessible from the internet so that you can get to them from anywhere, and that means we need to think about security issues. The chapter briefly talks about different layers in the conceptual architecture, from the business processes, and that's how we make decisions, how the work occurs, the software components, the hardware components, and then the outputs of the system. And we need to think about all of those as we diagram and design our architectures, or as we look at putting a DSS on top of our architectures, we need to make sure we understand those components of the architecture. Slide number 11 gives you some benefits of defining the architecture. I'm not going to go over those, but you should look at it. I think the key thing is that it provides that documentation and structure so other people can add to the capabilities of the information systems in the organization if we understand our architecture. Slide 12 is almost too simplistic as a diagram. The only thing I would tell you is that there's a more sophisticated diagram in the book in Chapter 6 that shows a more distributed network. The simplest architecture is one server, a local area network with a few machines attached to it. It doesn't even go out onto the global internet. That's what this picture shows, the simple architecture. And we build from there, from a shared server, possibly with a shared database, and machines that can access perhaps a printer from the server or access files that are on the server or applications. And we build up from that. A colleague wrote a book on decision support systems, and he said the architecture should tell us about databases, the models, the software tools, the hardware and the operating system, and those are all part of our documentation for the decision support system and our understanding of the architecture. Now, slide number 16 is more particular to data warehouses, and it's not really covered in Chapter 6, but it takes a little different view of the architecture. It's basically saying that the architecture is everything that we would normally think about in describing the system. So it's the problem we intend to address, the objectives and constraints, who the participants are, the components, the enhancements or modifications, the maintenance schedule, the skills, tools, and support. What you need to know is there's no agreement in the profession on what goes into an architecture document. Do we just want to look at the different levels from business process to outputs? Do we want to look at it in terms of the components of a decision support system? Do we want to look at it more as a systems analysis, as systems design that we've put together? So there's no agreement on what goes into an architecture document. We do a lot of drawings, we write a lot of words, but not everybody does the same thing when they put together an architecture document, whether for IT in general or for decision support systems. So you guys get to make it up a little bit as you go along to meet the needs that you have in your organization, the size of your organization, and what your boss wants. Well, what is a network? A network is a tool to allow computers to communicate with each other. We've had networks since the late 1960s. So we've had networks for almost 40 years now. To you, that may seem like a long time. To me, it's amazing that we've had them such a short time. But for almost 40 years, we've had networks. The networks we had in the early 70s were very primitive. The first networks we had were one computer talking to another computer. We didn't have global networks until really the end of the 1980s. And we didn't have public networks that were accessible until about 1994. So we've only had the public internet that was accessible with the web applications for about 14 years. So web-based architectures are very recent, since you were born. Now, you've grown up with the internet. That's a plus, but it makes you perhaps cavalier taking it for granted. There's still lots of improvements we can make in the network. The network provides a common language for computers to communicate. And with networks, we have some machines out on the network we call hosts, and they allow us to share information. We are embarking on a new network. We're going to deploy Internet 2. Some parts of it are already deployed. How many of you have heard of Internet 2? Nobody. Okay. What's mine? What's Internet 2?
Just like the different interfaces that are like what's on the Internet?
No, Internet 2 is going to be a network that's at least 10 times faster than the current network. So it's going to support high availability video, okay, real-time video, so that you'll be able to have things like movies on demand on your TV set, and you could watch them in real time because the internet connection to your house is going to be fast enough. You won't have to download them and wait for a slow download. You'll be able to have more than 30 frames per second video on your network connection. So we're going to have Internet 2, which will be at least 10 times faster than our current infrastructure. And on some parts of the backbone right now in the United States and in other countries, we already have 100 megabits per second on the backbone. Ethernet, the standard, is 10 megabits per second. Okay, but we're going to at least have a tenfold increase in our network speed. Now, we don't know if we're going to be able to do that over copper wires or if we're going to have to run fiber to everybody's house. Right now in Cedar Falls, the plan is for Cedar Falls Utilities to run fiber to every house so that you can have 100 megabits per second to your house. And all the new internet cabling that's run is fiber to the house. So in the new additions in South Cedar Falls, that's all going to be fiber. And they're going to have to refit that because they have fiber out to nodes, and then to people's houses you run copper wire, which slows down transmission speeds. Yes?
Can't we run gigabit over Ethernet, though?
And we're going to have, and on some parts of the network you can have a gigabit over Ethernet. But right now, our internet speeds if you go check your transmission speeds,
yeah,
you're only running maybe at 3 or 4 megabits.
Yeah, at the most.
Okay, and that's if you've got a, we're talking about at least 10 and maybe 100-fold improvement with Internet 2. And a lot just depends on the physical infrastructure that we get out there to what it's going to be. But it's there. We have the protocols. We already have some parts of it operating. There's an Internet 2 link between you and I and Iowa State right now, and to 300 universities and to some corporations, and some of our traffic goes on it, but if your speeds getting to it are slow, it's like you're just on the freeway or the superhighway for a little bit, so it speeds it up a little bit, but not as much as it would be if you had that superhighway all the way from your desktop to the servers that you want to use. So the networks are going to get faster. They're going to be increasingly fiber-based everywhere. And that means we're going to have to reconfigure lots of our networks and organizations. And wireless. We're talking about creating a wireless network for the whole United States. So you'd be able to basically have wireless internet that was high speed anywhere. So that may mean we...
How much would all that infrastructure cost, though?
Well...
Would that be be like out.
I think right now they're estimating that that spectrum sale could net the government about $8 billion, and then build out might be $30 or $40 billion or more to build out the network. So, yeah, it's expensive. And all the fiber is going to be expensive, too, if we have to put fiber there. So, we'll see. We have a lot of different infrastructures. Right now, we rely on Ethernet and a little bit still on serial line. We don't do token ring anymore. We don't do modems. Ethernet has been around since about 1976. It was developed at what was then Bell Labs. It was a protocol for 10 megabit per second transmission across copper wires originally, and we've enhanced that protocol. Ethernet basically is a packet-oriented thing. That is, every machine has to have an address for Ethernet to work. So every physical machine here has an address if it's on the Ethernet network. And computers come with addresses. So every computer you buy has a unique address. It might be hard to find it, but they do have that. Token ring was a protocol that IBM tried to use, and we used that until the early 1990s. But it was slower, and it required twice as much copper wire to run token ring. But it was supposed to be more reliable, so a lot of companies put it in place. Serial line is what we use when we hook a computer to a printer. We just run a wire from the computer to the printer, and we send information over to the printer. Now, that could be a USB port that we run the printer off of. It could be a serial line. It could be a parallel port. But it's just a wire connecting the computer with a device. And we don't do modems anymore except for what we call cable modems, which aren't really modems. Okay, a modem ran over the telephone lines, and cable modems are running over the television cable networks. So it is a device that translates your signal so they can go across the cable lines. We have to have protocols or rules. Today, we use TCP/IP, and you've all heard that before, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. What's it stand for? And I like to put that on my exams to see if people know what it is. So, Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol. Okay. And then IPX was a Novell proprietary protocol, as was AppleTalk, but Novell has gone to TCP/IP, and Apple machines have TCP/IP now. So I won't test you about those. Just know that there are other protocols, and there's still some other protocols out there that people are trying to advocate that are better than TCP/IP. But TCP/IP is firmly entrenched, and it's not going away. So if you want to understand the stack for networking, understand the layers in the TCP/IP stack. Okay. That's the stack you want to understand if you're going to get technical. Yes?
Where does the IEEE standards, where do those come in networking?
Well, IEEE does standards for hardware and...
Oh, yeah.
But TCP/IP is not under IEEE. It's if they want to make changes, it's kind of a... they have a group that handles that, but it's a pretty established protocol right now.
IEEE?
No, TCP/IP. Yeah, but IEEE does a lot of the engineering standards, so they're more hardware oriented in their standards rather than software.
Okay.
So they'll do things like the standards for USB 1.1, 2.0 for FireWire, those kinds of things. Which, you know, involves some software. You've got to have hardware standards before you can write software to address devices. All right, well, local area networks, we have one in this room, and there's one in the building. When you go out on your desktop, you've got some drives that you can access that are on a server in the back of the room. Behind the window back there, there's a server, the CBA net. And to get to that, your machine has to have a card in it, or it has to be built in, and we call that a network interface circuit or a NIC. This printer over here has to have a network interface circuit. Every addressable device on the network has to have a network card so that it can interact with the network and you can send and receive information from it.
You can share that printer off that computer.
Off of which?
It doesn't have to have a network card, right? You can share that computer.
No, the network card
is in there. I'm saying you could just share it though.
But the network card just means that it's recognized. That sharing is a software capability.
But it's still a device on your network that doesn't have a network card, right?
Now, every device on the network has to have a network card unless it's a virtual device. Mm. If it's a physical device, it has to have a network interface circuit in it. Okay. And if you look at the printer, there's a wire. I mean, it's even if it was a wireless device, it'd have to have a network interface circuit in it. But it's wired. It plugs into the network. Okay. Now, in your machines, it's an Ethernet card. And there has to be an Ethernet card in there, too. And that has an address, because the device has to be addressable on the network. Okay. And those addresses are in hexadecimal, I think. So, we don't want to go there. And I wouldn't swear they're in hexadecimal, but I think they are. Huh?
The MAC addresses?
No, for the Ethernet cards. Okay, and then if you want a network like Windows servers or Novell, you have to have some network operating system that allows people to share resources. And that's what allows us to share the printer. So when we take and make a printer network accessible, we go and we tell that printer that we make it visible to the network. Because that printer is actually coming off of the server. Okay. When we send information to that printer, it still needs to go through a computer. Okay. Or there's a computer in the printer. And this printer may have a computer in it. Sometimes that's what we do too, is rather than hanging a printer off of a computer, we put a computer in the printer so it becomes a complete device on the network. All right, well, in terms of what TCP/IP does, I'm going to throw all this jargon at you, and you may have heard it before, but this set of rules enables dissimilar nodes. Dissimilar means they're different. Okay, in terms of the operating system, most likely the operating system, and the hardware somehow differs, to communicate with each other. So we can have a machine that's running Unix from Sun Solaris, or running Linux, or running a Windows server, or running a Windows XP operating system, all communicate and share data because of the TCP/IP protocol. They all follow the same rules when they send packets of data out onto the network. TCP/IP has been around for quite a while. It did come from military research and the military's desire to get a reliable network that would continue even if there was damage to the network in some kind of a military confrontation with the Soviet Union. Slide 24 is a picture that's not in the chapter. Usually you only have to go to this kind of screen once when you set up a computer to go on the network. And if you don't do it very often, I recommend you call the help desk if you're doing that. Or when I did it, I called Cedar Falls Utilities and they walked me through doing the configuration. It's something where the menus are pretty intuitive, but you want to get it right. So like if I have a new machine and I want to set up email, I just did one with Vista a month ago. I called to make sure I knew if it was SMTP or if, you know, and what the inbound mail address was and the outbound mail address was and what the network settings were to take advantage of the network. The key thing is, this is the protocol you're going to use, TCP/IP. It's gotten simpler, Because all these others, we don't use much anymore. Okay? So it has gotten easier for those of you who are familiar with it to do your own setup for a personal computer on a network. The choices are much more limited now, and some even, that's the default, because they know that's what everybody has. Well, I'm not going to say any more about why TCP/IP. You can read about it. The reality is, it's the dominant protocol. If there's one protocol or set of rules for communicating with one PC to a server or other PCs, that's what you need to understand. Whether it's peer-to-peer or client-to-server, whether it's, quote, a web server, everything's going with TCP/IP right now, pretty much. So the objective with TCP/IP is to get from one host or computer to another. We don't need a direct connection, because we're going to send packets of data out onto the network, and some other computers on the network are going to get the data to the servers and to the machines we're interested in. How many of you have heard the story about how TCP/IP works? No? Well, the best thing to keep in mind is it's kind of like a letter. When you send somebody a letter, you put your letter inside and you address it, and then you put it in a postal box. TCP/IP works like that. Your computer takes and it breaks up your data and it puts them in envelopes. We call them packets. And then it sends them out onto the network. Each of those envelopes has an address on it. We call that the header for the packet. And there are different sorting places on the network that will read those addresses and get the packets to the right place, just like the post office has sorting for envelopes, you know, to get it to who you're sending it to. The computer networks have sorting features, and they read the addresses, and they get it to where it's going to go. And then, when it gets there, that computer software will read the packet, will reassemble the data, and it may then send data back. So if we're sending a request to a web server, we send a packet of data to that web server, and then it sends back to us more packets of data that create the web page for us. Same thing happens with email. When we send an email, our message gets broken down into a lot of packets that go to some kind of a computer that stores those packets till you go up and read them, and then it assembles it into your email message. So at the level of data transfer, we break the data down into packets, which are like letters, in that the data is the letter, the envelope is the packet, and we put an address on it, and we put it in the mailbox, and it goes out on the internet. And it happens really fast. So, right now, and you've heard this, I know, when I go to the next page, I'm going to send a request to a web server, because this is not in cache. This page is not in cache. And you watch how fast this is. And this web server is out in Massachusetts, where these files are stored. Actually, these files could be, I don't know where they are. They could be in Colorado, but they're not anywhere close to Cedar Falls, Iowa. And I'm going to send a request to the server when I click on the icon for the forward button, and it's going to basically say get slide 27. That message is going to get routed through the CBA network, through the UNI network, out onto the network, and it could go through as many as 20 or 30 different servers and routers before it gets to the server. And you've all seen packets, right? You've seen ping, where we ping a network and you see all the where all the data goes. Well, it's going to do that. So, how long do you think this request is going to take? And we only have, at best, 10 megabits per second. Think about how fast it'd be if we had 100 megabits per second or a gigabit per second for data transfer. That page was not in cache. We had to send a request that was broken down into packets, and that request was maybe more than one packet, but probably only one packet. So we sent one envelope out on the network and went through a lot of different computers. It went to the server where that page was stored. That server had to package the data and send it back to us. And it happened so fast that we hardly noticed any delay. Now that is magic. That's amazing. I'm always amazed when I think about the complexity that occurs behind the scenes that most people aren't even aware of in terms of how this global network works. You need to appreciate that and understand it if you're going to exploit it. Well, security. Just because things happen so fast doesn't mean that the network's secure. We can intercept those packets. We can put a computer out there on the network that can capture those packets and potentially read them unless we encrypt the data. So we can write software that will capture packets and reassemble them. And all those computers that it goes through is potentially archiving all that data that comes through it. So every email you send is probably archived out on the network somewhere, and maybe 10 or 15 times as it goes through different store and forward email systems. You all know that Google archives every query. Every query that goes through the Google search engine gets archived. Okay, they archive the domain name that it came, the IP address, what the search query were, the time, as much data as they collect. And web pages collect quite a bit of data. They don't know your name, but they've got a lot of information about those queries, and they store all that. That's why Google has over 100,000 servers with immense amounts of storage on them, because they store so much. Have you ever wondered how Gmail can give you all that free storage? It's because Google has lots of storage. Basically, storage is cheap. It's free if they can show you ads. So, security is important. We have to be very careful about sending data out over the internet if it's sensitive data. And if we send a query remotely to our data, we want to make sure that nobody's going to be able to intercept that. So we may use a secure client like Citrix, or we may use encryption, but we need to think about that. We'll definitely use passwords. Now, when we think about security, we have to ask how much effort we want to make to secure the system. I never cease to be amazed at how hard it is for people to get into their email systems, how often we have to change our passwords. To tell you the truth, my email is not so sensitive that I need to change it every 3 or 6 months. And I'm not certain I need a password that has to be at least 8 characters and have a number and a special character. You know, I don't think anybody is really going to try to break into my email account. And if they did, it'd be pretty obvious if they were abusing my account. It would show up really quick, and we could probably track down that person. So we have to decide how we impact our users with security and how much security we have. That's why it's nice to have a single username and password. In our systems, we're trying to do that. It's called single sign-on. It's good because you only have to remember one password, but usually it means that we're going to force more frequent changes in the password. So you've got one username and one password, but we impose more security on it because it is useful on more systems. Well, I'm about out of time, so I just want to quickly say that to implement security, we need to identify the threats. They may be physical, damage, but they may be people threats. So we need to have a computer security policy. We need to watch out for hackers. There are people who want to get sensitive corporate data, and people can break into systems. We have thousands of break-ins every year, but the most common threat is people stealing portable computers. That's the biggest data breach that we have out there, is that managers are careless with their portable computers, and those portable computers have lots of data on them that's sensitive, and that they don't even have a password on their portable computer, so somebody can open it up. So most of the security threat comes from carelessness, not from intentional hacking. How do we remedy the problems? User education. We may want some password aging, but too frequent password aging creates problems too. All right. The first line of defense for security is passwords. TCP/IP is here to stay for the foreseeable future, for at least the next 10 years in my opinion. Network speeds are going to increase. Architectures are getting more complex. We need to redo a lot of our architectures, so there's going to be a lot of work for system integrators. Decision support systems have to sit on top of the existing IT architecture and infrastructure, so we need to have some slack built in so that we can build neat systems. These three topics are kind of intertwined like a rope. So three strands of the same rope. The rope is stronger when each of the strands is strong. If one of those strands is weak, then the whole rope is weak. So keep that analogy in mind, and I'll see you on Thursday. We're going to do Chapter 7. Thank you.